time, we were told we'd get very sick if we went swimming. We went on a small boat off St Kilda Pier. The little boat tipped over and I thought I was going to die.
I remember really clearly in primary school, the boys and girls used to fight over who had the most amazing bathrooms. We'd brag and we'd make up these fantastical bathroom worlds that the boys could not access. Less of a loo, more of a luxurious powder room. Of course, like at all good primary schools, the taps ran ice cold Coke, and we had a bowl of lollies in the middle of the room and a butler, which would have been totally inappropriate now that I think about it. And they played so fresh hits of summer on a bathroom sound system. That kind of stuff. The boys didn't know what they were missing out on, but today they'll find out. Today we're taking you into the powder room because we've magically got two stories that fit that very specific theme. So join us in the private space we've filled with a kind of mysticism, discretion and secrecy. It's okay, I wasn't recording on the loo, that would be weird. And we're only just getting to know each other. I'm Ash Bertabez, you're listening to All the Best. Now, get comfortable. Stock up the chocolate, boil the kettle, and put on your trackies. You're about to have your very first period. Except it's the 1940s and there are no disposable tampons. And you've never even heard of a period. Mina Enova brings us this one.
One of my favourite movies is the 1976 version of Carrie. In the opening scene, Carrie gets her period for the very first time in the girls' locker room in high school. She's screaming and she's crying and the other girls are pelting her with tampons. It's traumatising. Carrie has no idea what's going on with her body, but in the past, this experience wasn't limited to horror movies. Before the internet, before sex ed, and before talking freely about your period was even remotely acceptable, there were girls who had never heard of a period before starting their own. For me, my first time interrupted an episode of Doctor Who, but was generally no big deal. I'd been given the talk, I had the supplies, no drama. I wanted to know what it was like to start your period in a time when talking about menstruation was met with red faces and a change of subject.
I remember that it was Friday night and it was Guy Fawkes night.
This is Margot. She got her first period in 1949.
This was on the beach at Middle Park and all of a sudden I noticed some blood on my undies and I thought, I've cut myself. Oh, I thought, oh. I went home and I was crying and I said, what's happened? And Mummy, a beautiful mother, Mummy said, that's right, Margot, you've got your periods. So she went, like a mother, she had the menstruation equipment already in her underwear drawer. She was a tailoress and made everything. And it was a homemade, we used to call them sanitary belts.
Margot tells me about this awful contraption with straps and clips and buckles that girls would attach their reusable pads to.
And you slip them on and they had a little tab in the centre and a tab in the back. We were told to soak them in a bucket with salt, which we did, and Mummy tipped them out. She did everything for us. We were ruined and spoiled. She tipped the water out and then she put them into the old-fashioned washing machine at the time. And then on the line with pegs, neatly hidden from other clothes. And then when they were dry, they were folded by Mummy and ready for her spoiled daughters to wear for the next period.
So far, not so bad, right?
At that time, we were told we'd get very sick if we went swimming. Cheryl, my twin and myself, we went on a small boat off St Kilda Pier onto the shore at St Kilda Beach, the little boat tipped over. And I thought, I've got wet, I'm swimming. and I thought I was going to die.
Thanks to modern science and disposable tampons, today's girls tend to be a little less anxious about their period. But sanitary belts aside, Margot's experience isn't too different from that of girls nowadays. Even today, most girls will turn to their mother to help them out during their first period. But not everyone has a mum. And in the 1940s, there weren't many other places to turn to. Proper sex ed in school was still a few years away in Australia, and there was no chance of Googling, "Why is my vagina bleeding?" Some girls had to figure it out on their own.
Well, my mother died when I was 12 and a half, so I wasn't told anything by my mother, and it was up to my sister to tell me anything.
This is May. By the time she got her first period in the mid-40s, her family had lost their mother to cancer and was struggling financially.
And she wouldn't have given me much information because she's only 2 years older than me, so she would have known a little bit, but I didn't have a clue. In them days, we couldn't afford tampons and Modus and all that sort of thing. We used to have to use rags.
The first disposable pads, made by Modus and Kotex, were only just coming into widespread use in Australia. For girls like May, the price point was just out of reach. She and her sister would tear up old sheets or clothes to stuff in their underwear. It wasn't an ideal solution, but they were forced to make do.
Oh, it was awful. Now I think about it, you girls are happy, you know. I lived out at Bendigo and I never had money and I was never told that you could buy these things, and I don't think you could then. It's wonderful the way they teach the young ones these days, but we were just thrown in the deep end. I was just told that's it. that's it.
Things have changed a lot in the last 60 years. Girls and boys learn all about menstruation at school, and there are even apps to help you track your cycle. So how are girls faring these days?
I first got my period when I was in grade 6.
This is Indy. She's 14.
And I kind of vaguely knew what periods were. I was quite proud because no one had in my family had gone their period this early, so I felt like more of a woman. I think that we were educated well because we had like an hour and a half talk about, you know, what a pad is, what a tampon is, things like that.
One of the most significant changes since the 40s and 50s is the loss of the taboo surrounding periods. Generally, girls today are more comfortable talking about their changing bodies.
It's a lot more of a conversation now for especially young girls. I don't think it was very ladylike to talk about. Now we're educated like very well, I think. You know, you're told about what to use, you talk about it with your friends, with your family.
India's right in that menstruation was just not talked about back then. And it's awesome that times have changed. But even today, not all girls enjoy the same freedoms. Whether it's for cultural, financial, or systemic reasons, menstruation is still an experience of embarrassment and shame for thousands of girls around the world. Slowly, things are changing, and girls are gaining more control over their bodies. It all starts with conversation.
Well, I think it's totally normal now to be able to speak about things like that changes with your body, because it's always been there. Just speak about it. It's normal. It's life. It's physical life.
That story was by Nina Enova, with help from supervising producers Beck Fari and Selena Shannon. This story was a collaboration between All the Best and a University of Melbourne journalism project called The Blood Series. You're listening to All the Best. And this week, we're going into the powder room, a secret women's world from a time gone by. Powder rooms. They didn't just preserve women of yore from the ghastly horror of mentioning the fact that they were off to take a sneaky leak. In the Victorian era, or the prudish era, powder rooms were literally where you would powder your wig. Our Victorian mates would have gone around smelling like perfumed talcum powder and sneezing. One of the few remaining old school powder rooms in Sydney is in the Queen Victoria building, of all places. Okay, maybe it's just a regular bathroom now, but the rest of the building is lost in time. It's full of perfumeries, boutiques, and tea rooms, reminding us of a time when women in corsets would duck off to fix up their hair, touch up their makeup, and tip the attendant on the way out. The days of powdery wigs may be over, but this next story gives the QVB bathrooms a new purpose.
I was told when I started learning singing, and I opted to do classical voice instead of voice for leisure, at that time not knowing the difference, that there were three roles for women, the witch's roles, the bitch's roles, and the britch's roles. So that is to say, the evil characters, the whiny characters, or the pants roles. So I had wanted to cobble together my own opera that challenged the roles of women in opera. My name is Clemmie Williams, and I am the director of Chamber Pot Opera. And I suppose one of three creators of the project and the originator.
My name is Thomas DeAngelis. I was brought on board to be a producer. I was also the dramaturg for the show. Clemmie asked me to coffee and glebe and said, I've got this idea for a show and I've always wanted to do it.
And I was thinking about what the setting for this should be, and kind of famously autonomous space for women is the women's bathroom.
What the sort of idea was, wouldn't it be great if we could do it in the QVB?
My partner said, QVB bathrooms are very nice. Dragged me up there and they were really nice.
Basically, I called the QVB and I got in contact with their general manager, and the general manager, like, it was such an easy process. Like, I reckon it took all of 2 days. They were back to us within a week and were like, we are very keen for this to happen, provided it doesn't impact on the stuff that's going on at that time of year. So we had a very limited window in which to produce the show. So that gave us a week, and we occupied the bathroom for that week. Only at night, though.
My name's Kieran. My role was the music director. So I accompanied on piano in the performances, and I took all of the music rehearsals as well. We had three characters that we kind of had to build up from scratch really quite quickly. I mean, it was a very short piece, and the idea was that these three characters are meeting each other for the first time, and they're also the audience is meeting them for the first time. The other thing is we wanted to choose things deliberately that were known and were popular, because the idea was to kind of turn the genre on its head a little bit. We wanted to get those pieces that were really representative of the genre in the popular imagination. So things like the Habanera from Carmen, that was one of those pieces that we went, yes, it's so typical of opera, so well, let's use that.
Well, there are three women, and so I wanted there to be three storylines. The storylines are based on those preconceived ideas. For example, the britches role, the pants role, the male role, is played by a woman, and so, and more often than not, that role is highly sexualized. So it was very important to me that we showed a woman being sexual, and it being okay. That particular story arc is of a woman that's just gone on a friend date, but then it's gotten a bit weird, and then it wasn't a friend date, and then, like, she went in for the kiss, and then she wasn't sure, and now she's trying to see if she can get any further by texting this person, and she's trying to apologise, but she's had too many drinks.
I have a request that you may disagree with. Kieran. I would like Britt's phone to ring a couple of times.
Here's the first one.
Ring, ring.
And she doesn't know whether she's kind of come on too strong or how it's all of those nervous first date feelings. She was getting text messages through one of her aria from the person that she'd been on a date with. So the music would be romping along and suddenly would come to a pause and then five text messages would come in or a phone call would come in. And that was quite funny because, you know, normally mobile phones are banned from the opera. You're not allowed to have them going off, but here they were going off in the middle of a piece.
Champagne, chocolate, wine, lollipop, cake, wine again.
Mainly food.
Just sugar.
I'm just in the food section.
I think that is one of the most fascinating things about opera is that you have those human characters there. Mostly, sometimes they're gods. But, you know, it deals with human situations and, you know, we do face those situations every day. And that's why it's a genre that's I do think is accessible if it's done well.
Nothing about opera means that it has to be this highbrow, serious thing that is only for the very privileged. Our objective at the outset was always to make it accessible because we were expecting an audience that wasn't completely across the subtleties of opera and the ins and outs of opera. And I think it was important that in the rehearsal room that was reflected. And I mean, that's a really convoluted way of saying that if you want people to have fun at your show, you need to have fun making it and doing it.
You see, the child with money is kind of like a mule with a spinning wheel. Damned if he knows how he got it, and damned if he knows how to use it.
Essentially, any particular joke that you can make about the opera was kind of a starting point for staging. Like, oh, do they sing from the cubicles? Yes, they do. Do they draw on the mirror? Yes, they do. Do they, you know, throw toilet paper around? Yes, they do. Because I wanted to play to the expectations of the audience, but then delight them beyond that.
My absolute favourite moment was when they performed the flower duet. It's a very, very famous duet for two females. And it's typically a very beautiful moment on stage and things kind of come to a standstill. Production, the two characters were forming kind of, they were decorating the bathroom with long strands of toilet paper, and they made this lovely kind of hanging decoration with toilet paper as they were singing the aria, which was a lot of fun. It was very, very funny to watch, but it ended up being quite beautiful as well. And then there was a small bubble machine that came on, which it drove me a bit nuts because the bubbles kept going all over the keyboard and suddenly the keys become very slippery. But that was, I think that was hands down my favourite moment because it was just this wonderful, very, very famous piece, very beautiful piece turned on its head, but still in its own way very beautiful.
It was a wonderful challenge and one I haven't experienced with my work this year, which was we sold out, and we sold out quickly because there were very few seats in the bathroom. Surprise, surprise. So I think kind of hitting on something so beautiful and not being able to share it with more people was quite a challenge. But, of course, it wouldn't be what it is without the intimacy. That's one of the most special things about it, is you don't usually get to see opera up close. So more often than not, an opera singer has to play to an audience, whereas in this situation they could just be. And I think that was a recurring note, and therefore another challenge for me was saying to the performers, you know, you don't have to act this moment, just be present in it, because we can see you, we can see your every movement. We're with you. You don't have to show us. Just relax into it.
The show was performed at the QVB, but the story was set in that QVB bathroom. Those women that came in to the bathroom during the show in the story had come from work or work drinks or a function in the city, and they had retreated into a very private space. There may very well be toilets in there, but there's a couch as well. Crucially, there's a couch, and there's big mirrors, and it's clean, and it's respite. It's about it being a place where one goes to be alone and safe, or together and safe, as it were.
One of my favourite parts was, I think, the first time we were in the QVB bathroom for a rehearsal, and we did Barcarolle. So when you hear two voices together in that incredible acoustic environment, your heart just kind of melts. So yeah, that's the short answer. I don't think there's a long answer. Yeah, it's just good to work with good people, kind people, talented people, intelligent people. I'm thankful for that.
That story was by Tegan Nichols. It was first broadcast on All the Best in 2016. We thought we'd play it again because right now the Chamberpot Opera is at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival in Scotland, and I've seen them get a few cheeky 5-star ratings in the men's toilet at the Assembly Hall. Have you ever listened to All the Best and kind of thought, yeah, I can do this? Well, we'd really love to hear from you. Get in touch via email at ep@allthebestradio.com. It doesn't matter if you've never made radio before, and it doesn't matter where you are in Australia. We partner you with an experienced mentor so you can make some radio magic. That email is ep@allthebestradio.com. ep@allthebestradio.com. All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne. Our executive producer is Selena Shannon. Our Victorian State Coordinator is Beck Fari. Our Community Coordinator is Chloe Gillespie. Beth Gibson is our SYN Production Manager. Tegan Nichols compiles our show. And I'm your new host, Ash Bertabez. Our artwork is designed by Annie Hamilton, and our theme music is composed by Shining Bird. All the Best is heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and also find our archives at allthebestradio.com. While you're at it, subscribe on your favourite podcast app.